Today, residents of a tower in Gaza received a call. They had 1 hour to leave their building before Israeli missiles struck. What happened next?
السلام عليكم ايش اخبارك؟
الله يبارك فيك يا هلا
حبيبي معك يا رياء الو
ايوه
On May 15, on the afternoon, exactly at 1:35 p.m., Tariq Mahdi just got the call. He told me that I was sleeping, cuddling my daughter. My wife was next to me, and suddenly from nowhere, a private number from the IDF is calling me.
It was 5 days into the latest Gaza war between Hamas and the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces.
So he picked up the call and he was totally surprised, and even you can hear it with his voice, that he was like shivering. And he was not understanding anything that's happening, especially when they said to him that we're gonna bomb the building.
Anas Mohammed Baba is a Palestinian photojournalist living in Gaza. He was at the tower that day. He spoke to those who were inside when that call came. The guy who answered, Tariq, he looked like he was about to be sick.
He was like under the drug. Totally like a zombie. He was totally incapable of talking at all. He was just saying, Israel, bombing the tower. Now we need to flee out. That's all.
The Al Jalah Tower, 11 stories in downtown Gaza, became one of the most enduring symbols of a war in the territory that appeared to spare no one. It housed two international media companies, the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. It was thought to be safe, untouchable. But there was no negotiating with the voice on the phone. The residents had an hour, and they recorded an incredible amount of what followed.
The rush, the mess, the struggle, it was like the last day of life. No one was just helping anyone, everybody just holding his kids and just fleeing out. Tears, screaming. We're talking here about the last minute of seeing your life. It's gonna be demolished in front of you.
This is the story those recordings tell, minute by minute, as dozens of people scrambled to escape an Israeli airstrike. From The Guardian, I'm Michael Safi. Today in Focus, a warning call and the terror that followed. Countdown to the destruction of Gaza's Al Jalah Tower. If you're thinking of homes in Gaza, what might come to mind is somewhere poor, crowded. But Anas told me, Al Jalah was not that.
Al Jalah was one of the most prestigious and luxurious buildings in Gaza. You can't be like someone regular or like a middle class to live in it. No, you have to be one of the silky prestigious class only in Gaza.
It wasn't just houses. It was the kind of place where foreign companies wanted to be.
It was also holding two of the main international press agencies, AP, Associated Press, and Al Jazeera. Both of those were just renting the rooftop because they knew that this place is one of the most safest places in Gaza.
The tower in downtown Gaza City, an area called Ramal, had been built by a family who sold high-end clothes, the Mahdis, who had been refugees from the violence that followed the creation of Israel in 1948, what Palestinians call the Nakba, or catastrophe.
Jawad Mahdi is the owner, and he's the one that's built Al Jalah building brick by brick. They were one of the most prestigious families in Gaza.
They weren't fighters. They played by the rules. Jawad Mahdi had something prized. It was a VIP pass issued by the Israeli government to enter and do business there. Jawad's son is Muhammad. And in Gaza, Muhammad lived a pretty aspirational life, one that a lot of people followed on Instagram.
He has around maybe 100,000 followers on Instagram. He's living the life that's he just waking up every morning, doing his cardio on his rooftop. Just seeing all of Gaza, the sunrise, he's sipping his coffee every day, reading for his kid. He always described Al-Jala family like their own safe area.
In a difficult place, Al-Jala was a safety net, a strong community of family, neighbors. In their home videos, you can get a sense of what life was like there. How, despite everything going on in Gaza, kids could still have a somewhat normal life.
All of them were just mentioning one thing, that Jawad Mahdi is like the grandfather for all of the kids here. We do celebrate the Christmas together, the Eid together, and we even have a very good relation with the janitor. They said to me that he's one of the family. He's working here for 15 years, so he's a part of this family.
But even with the privileges of wealth, Gaza was a besieged territory, and people in Al-Jala were not immune from the latest war there.
Gaza's health ministry says 9 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes on the territory. The strikes came after Hamas militants fired rockets from Gaza towards Jerusalem, after hundreds of Palestinians were injured in clashes at a Muslim holy site. The violence follows days of protests over plans to evict Palestinians from East Jerusalem.
In the many conflicts that Hamas and Israel had fought, Al-Rumal had usually been left alone. But this time, it seemed like no part of Gaza was being spared Israeli bombing.
I spoke with multiple families there, and they told me that after the third day of the war, we started just to pack all of the essentials that we need. And at the same time, we started to sleep on the corridors because it's safer. Because we could see with our pair eyes all of the explosions, all of the fire, and even all of the smoke that is very close from us. We started to feel like really soaked in fear.
And then, on May 15, 5 days after the eruption of fighting, at 1:35 in the afternoon, the Mahdi's got that call. It's worth pausing here for a second to note how weird this is, that the Israeli army sometimes bombs buildings the way you might visit your grandma, by calling ahead first. The Israeli army would later say that Al-Jala was targeted because of a military antenna on the roof. That's something the Mahdi's deny, AP and Al Jazeera saw no reason to believe, and for which no evidence has been presented.
Not only was Hamas in the building, they were actively using it to fight against Israel. They were using the infrastructure as their command center and intelligence center. They had special technological equipment in the building, which they used to actively fight and disrupt Israeli actions. And as such, we deem it to be a legitimate military target. And out of consideration for human life and for the people who work there, we chose to forfeit additional military gains by surprise attacking. And instead, we did what, of course, is the right thing to do, advance warning and allowed everybody to clear, vacate the premises and made sure...
But that afternoon, in that phone call,
Hello.
There was no debate about reasons. The message was simple. The jets are coming. You have an hour to get out. The clock started.
In certain situations, we Gazans, we have like a procedures to handle something like that. And Mahdi families was having their procedures. The first thing that we need a leader to evacuate all of the place, and the best leader here is Jawad Mahdi. So they handle the phone to Jawad Mahdi.
Hey Jawad Mahdi, hey Jawad. Hello. Hello. Jawad Mahdi.
In order just to buy some time. After that, Jawad asked his son Muhammad particularly start from the rooftop and start going down and just inform every single apartment here that they need to evacuate immediately without taking anything. We don't have time. I spoke to Muhammad and he was just saying to me that Anas, I was taking the stairs like a flash. We turned off the elevator and I started with Al Jazeera and I started with the AP and they were totally denial about that. And after that, I just started not knocking on the door. I was like broken the door and screaming, "Evacuate now, evacuate now. We don't have time. They're gonna bomb the building."
The ninth floor of Al Jalla was home to the Al Jarusha family. There was Muhannad, a well-known businessman, and his wife, Susan. Anas jokes that her passion is Louis Vuitton, something that she passed on to her two daughters, who were the family's focus, along with their two cats. Nobody had been sleeping much during the evenings, but that afternoon felt quiet, a lull.
So in May 15, Suzanne Al Jarusha, she started the interview with me with one sentence. Muhannad left me to just check on his business that got demolished. One of my daughters, she was asleep with the cat, and the other one was just playing with her dolls. And I was standing in the kitchen preparing the meal that all of the family loves it. Because we were totally frightened. For the past 3 days, we were just sleeping at the corridor.
Then she heard knocking on the door, loud, urgent.
She told me that once I heard all of that heavy knocking on the door, I didn't even need to hear who's there. I was totally sure that we need to evacuate. I opened the door, I saw Muhammad Mahdi screaming, "Everybody is just evacuating." I took my daughter, the sleepy one, and I took the other one, and I just took the stair screaming and crying, "Muhannad, where are you? Muhannad, where are you?"
The order to run wasn't unexpected. Everyone had been preparing for it. But this wasn't a drill, and nothing could really prepare Susan for that knock when it actually came.
She told me that she was just preparing around 16 suitcases in order just to evacuate if something happened. But when the true moment came, she couldn't handle to take anything except one suitcase, which is have a BJs for her daughters and some clothes for her and nothing for her husband. And another suitcase which was having the IDs, the official documents, some money, not all of it, and a backpack which was holding some of her jewelry.
A family's entire life was in that apartment. Susan managed to carry out two suitcases. Everything else stayed behind. It was 41 minutes until the bombing was scheduled.
She just described it as the worst moment she ever had in her life. For her, just rushing on the stairs like this, scrambling all of this luggage. Everything is just like upside down. Everybody just pushing. Everybody just wants to save his own life. I was totally terrified that I lost one of my daughters, but I was asking them very strictly, "Don't leave me."
Dozens of families making their way down the stairs. Kids, office workers, everyone with suitcases, boxes, carrying anything they could, rushing down narrow steps, the clock ticking.
Muhammad told me that fear was everywhere. He just started to describe the screaming of the children, the crying, and even that there is some people who just lost their own child on the streets. They couldn't even find them. Muhammad told me, at the right moment, I stopped and everything around me stopped with me. I was like, okay, my brother is just saying farewell for his apartment. And when he just get out of his apartment, he didn't close the door. Just like this, he's saying, "This is the last time of our life I'm gonna see you." This moment broke him in a part.
Susan and her daughters made it to the bottom. They were safe. The panic subsided. Standing in front of her home, that's when it hit Susan, what was really going on.
She just started to cry. she gave herself one last peek at the building. And after that, from nowhere, she started to shout, "Muhannad, where is Muhannad?
Oh, Muhannad!"
Everybody on the street was able to hear Suzanne screaming for Muhannad. She was calling Muhannad while she's just dragging her suitcase and her two daughters behind her.
2:11 p.m. 24 minutes until the Israeli deadline. The evacuation was complete. The residents looked around, counting, taking in faces, and one of the Mahdis realized not everyone was there.
Every evacuation have its own mistakes. And the only mistake in Al Jalaa Tower was Mr. Waleed.
Mr. Waleed, Waleed Hussein, had been an oil engineer in Texas and then worked for a bit in the Gulf. He was a US citizen, but his mum in Gaza was sick. And so he came back. He'd been there 6 months. And while everyone was panicking, rushing, taking what they could, Waleed and his family had been asleep. Nobody had woken them up.
This is what they told me. "Oh, Waleed, because you're not Abu Khalid, you're not that social." I said, "What the hell? What the socialist? Why didn't you call me? Otherwise, we could have just been demolished with that building."
So one of the Mahdi's family sent his two kids to keep knocking on Waleed's house and telling him, "You need to evacuate now without any belongings. You are the last one here."
I was really like dizzy. I couldn't focus. I'm dreaming. They're serious. They can hit the tower. This kind of feelings. Maybe not.
When I spoke to Waleed, Waleed was totally devastated. He was like a broken person in front of me. He was just recalling the moment that he said that, "For me, I took my children, my wife, and we evacuated without taking anything, even our slippers. We didn't take it."
Waleed's kids hadn't been in Gaza long. When their dad said, "The building's about to be bombed, we need to run," they didn't get it.
"I need to get my stuff, Dad. I need to get my school bag." I said, "Let's just go, let's leave. I will get you a new one." Believe it or not, the way she was crying, it tears my heart. 7 years old, what can you say? As a dad, what can you say? Nothing.
Making their way down the steps, one of the girls froze. There were about 20 minutes until the deadline.
My daughter, Maryam, the fourth floor, she stopped. And one of the guys, Al Jazeera or AP, who's the one who carried her, he helped me till the entrance of the tower. So it was really very, very difficult, very bad situation. But the way I saw people outside the tower, man, it's like you're going to hell. None of them knows where to go. We reached with nothing. Wallahi, it was really a disaster.
This whole time, Jawad Mahdi, the building's owner, is on the phone with the Israelis. He's negotiating for more time. The Israelis say no. They're watching all this, and people are worried that if anyone goes back into the building, it could be bombed before the deadline. Waleed is at the front of the building. His priority, his family, are safe. But he begins to think about what they've left behind. Their Palestinian IDs, their US passports. They wanted to get as far away as possible, but they didn't even have their car keys. It was 2:17 p.m., 18 minutes to go. The family knew exactly where the keys were in the apartment. They were so close. All of a sudden, Waleed saw Khalil, his 17-year-old son, run back inside.
Can you imagine when your son is going, what kind of emotions and, you know, feelings you have? Maybe that kid is not going to come back, so you will never forgive yourself. Can you imagine what kind of situation it goes through your mind?
Khalil made it in and out. Meanwhile, on the top floors of the building, journalists from AP and Al Jazeera were still in their offices, calling people in the US, Qatar, Israel, trying to find anyone who could stop this. At the same time, they were trying to clear out offices from which they'd worked for more than a decade.
cameras, archives. They built something like a human body lines.
It's 15 minutes until the rocket strike is scheduled to begin. Everyone's out of the building. Muhannad Al-Jarusha, he's Suzanne's husband, who went to check on his business, finally arrives. He sees his family, and he sees who's missing.
The first thing that he said after just checking on his wife and his daughter, that's where is the cats? That moment was like a disaster for Suzanne and for the daughters, that they forgot the cats. But the crazy thing here that Muhannad Al-Jarusha was like trying to enter the building to evacuate the cats.
Don't tell me. He was trying to go inside to get the cats with less than 15 minutes left.
Exactly. He was trying, but all of the people on the street was holding them to like stop him by force. Because the Israelis' orders was totally clear that nobody enters the building.
Fluffy and Mishu. The cats were like family.
They raised them. Muhannad describes those cats. He had four daughters, not two. Suzanne, she was totally clear that she hates cats. But after those two cats, she started to feel like she's a cat lover. They was just like the clowns of the house. They all even have two seats on the food table. They eat with them.
There's only a few minutes to go. Jawad Mahdi, the owner of the tower, was still on the phone with the Israelis. An hour ago, he'd been too shocked to argue. But as the deadline got closer, he got bolder.
Jawad Mahdi asked him the first question, why are you bombing Al-Jalaa Tower? The IDF gave them like the declaration that's because Tel Aviv got bombed by the militants in Gaza, we're gonna bomb Al-Jalaa as a response. So he was totally courage to tell the Israeli IDF, come on, I'm not asking you to not bomb it. Bomb it as you wish, but at the same time, give me extra minutes. When the IDF refused his request, I was totally shocked and surprised that Jawad Mahdi told him that, okay, go ahead, bomb the building and bye-bye. And he just turned off the mobile. He didn't even continue the call.
Four minutes to go, three, two. A crowd of 500 people, including Anas, gathered outside Al-Jalaa, waiting.
All of the Mahdi family, the residents, even the office owners, even the rest of the neighborhood, civil defense and ambulances, and even some of the police were present at that time just to witness Al-Jalaa building being bombed.
2:35 p.m. hits. It's the deadline. Time's run out. People look up to the sky.
First, it was nothing. We were there just standing. Some of us were recording. The Mahdi family were standing on the corner. And all of us were just waiting for the first bomb.
Nothing was happening. And for a second, people wondered. Maybe it was some kind of joke, psychological warfare. Maybe their homes would be spared.
We were standing on the street waiting for 45 minutes. The hope just started to raise in our chest, in our mind, that maybe the Israelis is just finally quit. They don't want to take it down.
It was 45 minutes of waiting?
Yeah. And then it happened.
Hasbi Allah wa ni'mal wakeel. Hasbi Allah wa ni'mal wakeel. Hasbi Allah wa ni'mal wakeel.
The first moment, the missile just hit the roof. And after that, another missile hit the foundation of the building. At the same minute, there was two big missiles just hitting the building. It was like a big fire, followed by a very, very, very huge dust and smoke. Everybody at a radius of maybe 3 kilometers of the explosion, they lost their hearing ability for maybe 5 to 10 seconds. The Mahdi family and the rest of the families, Manad and Jerusha, they started to cry and they started like to hug each other. Al Jazeera staff, they started to cry. AP staff started to cry. It just was one of the most terrifying, heartbreaking moments for us. Everybody was just trying to figure it out. Is it the end? Is this the last missile? Suddenly, another two missiles on the foundations of the building. All of the building was on the ground now. Once we just got totally assured that this is the last missile, all of the people that were in the radius of the site there, we rushed to see what's happened. It was totally dusty. You can't even breathe because all of the air in their area was suffocating you from the inside, burning things, and especially the smell of the bombing powder was all over the place.
The scene around Al Jalal was chaos. But what happened there was also, strangely, quite organised. The residents of the tower got a warning call, so there'd be no casualties. Their homes were destroyed to a timetable. Anas told me this wasn't unusual for Gaza. We know. A lot of the suffering that people in Gaza experience is the result of this very kind of careful calculation. Israel, along with Egypt, decides how much fuel can enter the territory, what kinds of construction materials and food. Hamas, too, calculates that firing rockets at Israel will draw a violent response, and civilians will be killed. They do it anyway. Palestinians aren't suffering because of a natural disaster. It's a managed one.
So once the resistance here, especially Hamas, achieved something like launching 100 rockets and maybe 10 or 12 rockets reaches the targeted areas in Israel, that means that Gaza needed to be punished. And how to punish a Gazan? Destroy Gaza itself.
Anas says the bombing of Al Jalal was calculated in another way too. He believes that destroying homes, especially those of wealthy, influential people, is meant to turn them against Hamas. But Gaza isn't a functioning democracy. It hasn't had an election in 15 years. Despite all the misery and destruction, both Hamas and the siege are still here. The Al Jalal Tower lies in ruins.
The Mahdi family just stand in front of the rubble of their own house and they just make a moment of silence. Like they're just saying farewell for our memories, farewell for their past life. The fire kept burning on the Al Jalal Tower for almost 7 hours. In the next morning, Jawad Mahdi and his two sons were just scavenging the rubble, and suddenly from nowhere, one of his sons found his wedding album and even his wedding tuxedo, like he's just left them.
That must have meant so much to them to find the wedding album and the wedding tuxedo that had somehow survived both the bombing and then the hours of fire that came after it.
I still remember that moment. The first thing that Jawad Mahdi did, he asked his brother, Hussam Mahdi, to take a picture of him holding his wedding picture. in front of the rebels. For him, it was like, yes, you destroyed my building, but you couldn't bomb my past. You couldn't bomb my memories. My memories just stay alive after all of this.
That's an incredibly powerful symbol. And I'm just wondering, as a symbol, what was the bombing of Al Jalal Tower? Was it something that even Gazans think of as something remarkable, or was it just more destruction in a war that was full of it?
It's very strange. It's an impossible thing. Why? Because it's just holding AP, an American agency, Al Jazeera, an international agency. It's holding the most luxurious people in Gaza, the ones who have a VIP to enter Israel. If those people now are under the scope, that means for the rest of the Gaza, that's no one and no place in Gaza is safe anymore. And trust me, this message was well delivered by the IDF.
Whenever you see journalists doing live updates from Gaza, they're usually standing on the roof of that building, which has now been flattened in an airstrike by the Israeli military. So that is a landmark, an institution that has now been razed to the ground in Gaza.
Coming up, the families who called Al Jalal home. 4 months on, where are they now? It's hard to believe that the latest war in Gaza was only a few months ago. The news has moved on from Al Jalal, but the people who lived in it are still trying to rebuild their lives. Muhannad and Suzanne Al Jarusha, with the two daughters and the two cats, moved in with a member of their family, but not for long.
They woke up on another bombing, just very close to their father's house.
So they moved again. But it's a far cry from their old life.
The only thing that they had at their new apartment is just mattresses, because they cannot afford more and more, especially after this crisis. He told me, let them take all what they take. The only thing that I want is just the cats and the safeness that I was feeling in my old apartment. I'm feeling like a homeless.
For weeks after, Muhannad would visit the site where the tower had been. He'd just stand there, listening.
Muhannad told me multiple times that every day he just visited the site in the early morning just to try to hear any sound from the cats. Muhannad told me that I know the cats are dead, but I can't just stop believing that they could be alive. Now, Al Jalal, they just took all of the rebels away, and Muhannad was standing there, just waiting for maybe the bodies of his cats, but even the bodies, he doesn't found them. And surprisingly, that was a relief for him, that maybe they just get out from here. Not finding the body gave him some hope.
Waleed, the engineer, moved in with his brother. Their family lost everything that day but their car keys. But worse than what they lost is what they gained, memories.
You know what's really, man, it's very terrible for kids. Nightmares comes to Maryam, to Shahid, to Jumana, in the middle of the night, screaming.
As a parent, he's struggling with the weight of responsibility.
To rebuild my life, me and the other 30 families, it takes forever, man. I try to not show them my problems, you know, like any dads.
For the Mahdi family, they've all split up now. Jawad Mahdi says he'll reconstruct, a luxury most in Gaza can't afford. But what he builds this time will be different. Not something grand and ambitious like Al Jalal, it's too risky. He wants a smaller place, just for the family. Over the 11 days of the most recent Gaza war, at least 256 Palestinians were killed. At least 13 people were killed in Israel. Some of the Palestinians who lost their houses in the most recent Gaza war have launched legal cases, both internationally and in the Israeli system, to try to hold the Israeli Defense Forces accountable. They want answers and compensation. It's a long shot and won't be quick.
In court, maybe it's going to take 7, 10, 15 years to be handled. So maybe the children, they're going to take back all of what they lose in this war.
And for you, Anas, as a Gazan and as a journalist who was there when this building was bombed, what stayed with you? How do you make sense of everything here that's happened?
I traveled for the first time of Gaza a month ago. It was to Egypt. I was totally fascinated that there is a life nicer than Gaza. Electricity was 24 hours. And at the place that I were there, they were totally looking at me awkwardly, like, why are you just moving around without even turning on the lights? I told him, I don't know, but it's just in my genes now. You know, you can't just imagine yourself out of Gaza. It's like that your mind, your thoughts, your head, it just restructured itself to be a Gazan. I do love being a journalist. It's my passion. But I was totally forced to be a war journalist. The Gazans here, they're tired of all of these wars. They are the victims and they can't do anything for it. But at the same time, they have something called hope. That tomorrow will be better.
Anas, I'm sorry that you've been forced into being a war journalist, but I'm glad that at least we've had the chance to talk to you, that you've been able to witness what happened and share it with us. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Anas Mohammed Baba, a photojournalist living in Gaza. This episode was based on reporting by Anas, Kamil Ahmed, Joe Dyke, and the organization he works for, Air Wars, who do incredible work monitoring the impact of conflict on civilians. Together, those three did the reporting that made this podcast possible. You can explore the interactive they produced about the destruction of Al-Jalaa at theguardian.com. It's called Countdown to the Airstrike. Courtney Youssef produced this episode. Sound design was by Axel Kakoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. Back tomorrow.